It's 1764, and we're standing at the top of a Lincolnshire hill. With us in our group of friends is a massive, shabby, shambolic figure, now aged 54, Samuel Johnson. And he's looking down from the top of the hill. Johnson, and I quote, delighted by the hill's steepness, said he wanted to take a roll down. Langton and others present attempted to stop him, but he persisted that he had not had a roll for a long time. Emptying his pockets, he laid down parallel with the edge of the hill and descended, turning himself over and over until he came to the bottom. Think about it. Dr. Johnson was a huge man, bigger than almost everyone around him. When they said literary colossus, they meant it. Though struck by various disabilities since he'd been a baby, he was physically very strong, athletic, and loved sports. Don't buy all that smoking room haze and scratching quills stuff, or rather, scale it down in the mix. Johnson enjoyed everything about life. He loved people. He could be childish and playful. He liked to race people and was exultant at winning, even against young ladies. There were acts of reckless bravado. Cast aside your preconceptions. This man was inhabited by a rollicking, chest-thumping, exuberant, puppying, yabba-dabba-doing sense of fun. Talking of which, my guest, the fellow who's chosen Dr. Johnson, Boris Johnson. No relation, I assume?
Not as far as I know, no. And obviously, if I could claim kin with the great man, I certainly would.
This Johnson, Boris Johnson, is his own Johnson. The CV, well, let's race through the key entries. He's 44, Mayor of London, former MP for Henley, former editor of The Spectator magazine, still a columnist for The Telegraph, educated all over the place, then at Eton and Oxford. Read classics, advanced as a journalist, has written books and is writing one now. He's, amongst other things, a popular historian. Survived accusations that he was involved in a plot to assault and batter another journalist who dissed his friend. Became a proper celebrity after several appearances on Have I Got News For You. Sacked by Michael Howard as shadow arts minister over an affair. Reappointed to the front bench by David Cameron, then persuaded to run for London mayor. Twice married, and the great-grandson of a prominent liberal Turk, interior minister to the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire, later murdered. Boris Johnson has described himself as a one-man melting pot. What is it, if one can put one's finger on it, that you admire about the man?
I think it is the mixture of genius, transparent genius, and this extraordinary emotional fragility and yet originality. He gets to the heart of human nature, and he mobilises language in a very, very special and powerful way. You see, what he did then, which nobody tries to do nowadays, except possibly on comedy chat shows, is he tried to defeat people in conversation. So he was an amazing character. He was a mixture between Paul Merton in terms of the repartee. Then you got a bit of Paxman as a sort of prober into the English psyche. That's a massive compliment to Jeremy Paxman, by the way, if he's listening to this. It's grossly overgenerous to him. And then, you know, also the Regius Professor of Greek plus a first-rate poet. And we've got nobody like that today. There's absolutely nobody who satisfies all those different qualities.
Our expert witness today is Peter Martin, eminent biographer of Samuel Johnson and of Boswell. Born in Argentina of English parents and educated there and in the United States, he's taught English literature on both sides of the Atlantic and written extensively on 18th century British and American literature and culture. Peter, in a nutshell, how is Johnson remembered today as opposed to how he was thought of in his time?
It's arguable that he isn't remembered very well by most people. My wife and I did a little sort of spot survey on the main street once in Chichester, and about 25% of them knew who he was. Some of them said he was a Conservative MP.
I think that's probably an insult to the people of Chichester, and you should be sent to apologise to them, because actually I'm sure that most people in Chichester are familiar with Samuel Johnson. And I think what he stands for most of us, is a great sort of harumphing, John Bullish political incorrectness. You know, when a woman preaches, it's like a dog walking on its hind legs. It's not done well, but it's a wonder that it's done at all. You know, he says the kind of things that it is very difficult to say these days, even in The Sun or The Daily Mail. I think people remember that element of him, his rebarbativeness, his rudeness, and I think it's something that appeals to people. Down, you know,
it is. It's very appealing. It's very appealing. And I think people do remember the sayings almost more than they remember the man. The various things, Boris, that you've just said people like about Johnson are things that have come through Boswell and have created a tradition about Johnson. which may or may not have anything to do with what Johnson actually wrote.
He produced the dictionary. He produced the most incredible, most amazingly ambitious literary effort. You know, there it was, in London, the greatest city on earth, with the greatest language on earth, and he has the whole stream of English words, and he decides that he knows what they mean, and that he, Johnson, is going to declare what they mean. I think that's a fantastically powerful, ambitious thing to have done, and people remember him for it.
Let's try to call to mind what the man himself looked like. Fanny Burney described him brilliantly in later life. He is indeed very ill-favoured. He is tall and stout, but stoops terribly. He is almost bent double. His mouth is almost continually opening and shutting, as if he was chewing. He has a strange method of frequently twirling his fingers and twisting his hands. His body is in continual agitation, seesawing up and down. His feet are never a moment quiet, and in short, his whole person is in perpetual motion. He must have created an incredible impression wherever he went.
Yes, I think it was the contrast between his sort of compulsive twitching and this sense that he was a genius. Everybody acknowledged at the time, throughout his life, that he was the incarnation of, you know, the genius of English letters. And people would go to his watch him getting up in the morning and hope that some pearl of wisdom would fall from his flobbery lips.
He was very attractive to women, too. I mean, they loved to sit next to him and talk, and he was very attentive. But he was a grotesque-looking figure. He had scrofula, had bad eyesight.
Well,
he was
almost
blind in one eye. And
let's start from the origins of that scrofula, which are right back in childhood. Tell us the date of his birth.
1709.
18th of September.
September the 18th.
So 300 years ago.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why he had scrofula, Matthew. It's very, very interesting, because his mother didn't wet nurse him. He was given to a nurse to be breastfed, and she passed on scrofula to him, which was the cause of his subsequent scarring.
Yes.
And he was then touched for King's Evil by the moniker of the dad's
Queen Anne, I think.
Queen Anne.
What were his family circumstances? It was Lichfield, wasn't it?
It was. His father was not very successful. He was a rather feckless businessman. He had this bookshop, and the family lived in that corner bookshop. And then he got a legacy of £40 to attend Oxford. And there he made quite a splash.
How did Oxford go for him?
Well, it went fine to begin with. As far as I can remember, he spends about a year there, and he shows great promise and great distinction. But then his father goes bust, and, you know, he feels this terrible, terrible moment of financial crisis. And another undergraduate takes pity on him and leaves some shoes outside his room.
It's a great story.
As a gesture of support, because poor old Johnson's got his toes are busting through his shoes. And Johnson, in his fury, throws the shoes out, or throws the shoes back at the other kid, I think. And
fierce pride.
Fierce pride, exactly. And then leaves Oxford. But that sense of being an academic failure, not making it, being a reject, I think haunted him. And that's one of the things that then drove him, this volcanic ambition, and drove him to try and succeed.
It seems to me he became an angry young man in an odd sort of way, because he obviously was angry, and he hugely resented the constraints of his poverty, and he also resented the slights that he felt he'd received from people in authority and from the rich. And yet at the same time, developing here is quite a conservative young man with really quite conformist ideas in many ways.
Well, he is a conservative, and he is appealed to constantly as a great example of the conservative spirit. But you've got to remember that being a Tory in those days didn't mean that you were necessarily on the side of the interests of the rich. You weren't always sticking up for the posh folks. On the contrary, a Tory was a person who stood up for the little guy, the shopkeeper, whatever. And that's why the monarch was an important figure in Tory politics, because you needed the monarch as a bulwark, as a protection against the Whigs, is that right?
He took the part of poor people,
correct.
Mad people, people on the fringes, on the edges of society. He gave lots of money to the poor. He had a deeply humane and humanitarian spirit.
Think about what he did for old Mrs. Williams, his blind poetess who hung out with him in his house. She had terrible table manners. She was a complete horror, and he used to take her with him everywhere. Then there was Frank Barber, his black manservant that he looked after, that he sprung from the Navy. He gave him his education. He then made him the principal beneficiary of his will. His cat, Hodges. Remember his cat, Hodges? Johnson himself goes to buy oysters for his cat, Hodges. I mean, this man may be a conservative, may be a Tory, but he is overflowing with the milk of human kindness.
It's been said about you, Boris Johnson, that you're impatient with huge doctrinaire ideological systems, but you're always ready to take a particular case, a particular individual, a particular injustice. Is that fair?
Well, I hope so. But I certainly think if you look at Johnson, Dr. Johnson,
yes.
you can see a man who was from time to time driven by, whether by guilt or compassion or whatever it happened to be, to take the most unusual causes and to defend them.
There is a weakness, though, in this impatience with systems of thought and concentration on individual cases. You find that Johnson is very perceptive in everything he says about how human beings are and what they do, but he hasn't anything very interesting to say about ideology.
Well, he has the most interesting thing to say about ideology, which is how small of all that human hearts endure, that part which courts or kings can cause or cure, which is a basic statement of minimalist conservatism. And you and I, Matthew, have spent many, many thousands of words writing exactly the same thing. Johnson completely summed it up. And his point is that actually ideologies do not necessarily serve human beings very much, or indeed speak to their real interests or to the things that drive them.
I think he also was feeling that ideologies are based on facile generalizations, and he hated what he called Kant.
Mm.
People loosely
not the German philosopher.
No.
Kant.
You know, people who loosely talked flim-flam and people who were hypocrites. You know, a lot about Johnson's gruffness can be traced to his anger about people who spoke nonsense and who got away with it socially. And he wasn't about to let people get away with this kind of, idle talk.
Exactly. He had a kind of very, very bluff Anglo-Saxon deprecation of anybody who spoke exactly what you can't twaddle. I mean, that's why he used all these words like dog and blockhead and dunce.
To shock.
And people loved that, this combination of massive erudition and this extreme rebarbativeness. What the English love, I think, is someone who is willing to be rude, because they suspect, probably often wrongly, that people who are rude are telling the truth.
Mm.
Because we're a nation addicted to embarrassment and hypocrisy and all the rest of it.
And individually, you know, as an individual, that tendency was fired strongly by this anger that was always rising up, I think, you know. He really resented people who were successes on the basis of less mental equipment than he had.
He was fantastically competitive.
Fiercely so.
I mean, he quotes Homer on Diomedes' advice, you know, Ai Aristou and Hypericon Emini Allon, always to be the best and defeat everybody else.
Back then to the trajectory of his career. He's left Oxford because he can't afford it.
He left, by the way, extremely depressed. He suffered from constitutional melancholia, which he said...
Clinical depression.
Quite. And it was a very severe case of it. He never got over this melancholia, and people sometimes think, well, he didn't suffer very much from it because he doesn't talk about it, but Johnson doesn't like to talk about himself.
He would have thought there was something slightly weak and self-indulgent about that kind of thing.
Indeed, he would have.
To his writings, then, multifarious and many of them forgotten, but...
He's remembered as a great literary figure, but he's not remembered particularly for his... In Rasselas, people don't read Rasselas much. His essays, I'm afraid, you know, if you want to find Johnson's essays, they're probably being dumped by council libraries in landfill at the moment. You know, that is the tragedy.
Irene is never produced.
Irene, no. I mean, well, I don't think it was produced much after 17, whenever it
people
was.
People should read these essays.
They should never... The essays are fantastic. Yes, but he is remembered for the way in which he puts his finger on human emotion. Can I read out a few key Johnson things that strike me as being utterly brilliant? Nothing is more hopeless than a scheme for merriment. Very good point, I always think. Yes. The safe and general antidote against sorrow is employment. The cure for the greater part of human miseries is not radical, but palliative. That has a deeply conservative insight. Every animal revenges his pains on those who happen to be near.
Totally and realistic.
Totally realistic.
You know, relentlessly realistic.
How did the writing start?
He did a lot of hack writing in Grub Street in London for the Gentleman's Magazine, reporting parliamentary debates anonymously, actually creating debates.
Making it up.
Well, no, he wasn't making it up. He received accounts of what had happened, and he would then you know,
make it
pad
up.
It up. Well, yeah. Come on. Well, you're undermining public confidence.
As a parliamentary sketch writer, I don't regard it as insulting to say that someone has made something up.
Yeah. Act of genius. But he then out of the blue, got a contract to write the dictionary.
I want to point out here, it took 40 Frenchmen 55 years to produce a dictionary of French. It took the Accademia de la Crusca 20 years to produce the Italian dictionary. It took Johnson, on his own, 9 years, and he did 40,000 entries.
He wasn't entirely on his own.
Well, he did 40,000 entries on his own, Matthew, which is an amazing, amazing feat of obsession-driven labour.
He married, in the end, a woman who'd been married already. She was 20 years older than him. Elizabeth Tetty, he used to call her. How did this come about, Peter?
He met her in Birmingham. Her husband had recently died, and she was all alone, and he was desperate.
She is a woman of protuberant bosom, we're told, and not much else.
Oh, well, on the contrary, I think she was rather bright.
But you have to wonder, and Freud would speculate as to why a chap who had been snatched from his mother's bosom would be attracted to Tetty. Later on, much older than him, and as I say,
he's a great talker.
Proportioned as she was.
Psychobiography.
The evidence would suggest that they were not happily married.
But he was completely distraught when she died.
I think grief is a complicated thing, particularly when you lose your spouse. And if you have any sense of guilt, and Johnson lived with guilt all his life about a multitude of things, it was an incremental guilt.
He kind of feasted on guilt, didn't he?
He did.
He used guilt to drive himself. And the most telling thing I remember reading about him was, something 50 years after his father has died, he remembers that he'd once failed to go to Uttoxeter to run an errand for his father at the bookstall there.
Great story.
And so he actually goes there in advanced middle age to stand bareheaded in the rain to try to, atone for this youthful failure.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to Great Lives, where this week the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, has chosen Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, on the 300th anniversary of his birth. Our expert witness is his biographer, Peter Martin. Boris Johnson, would he have been good on television?
Yeah, I think he would have been terrific, and he was made for a kind of comedy quiz show of the sort of Dave Channel variety, and he, never mind the Have I Got News For You, that kind of thing he would have been extremely good at, but he was also a grade A poet and
if the viewers could get over his physical appearance and his gesticulations and tics and abrupt movements and so forth, which now people tend to think was a case of Tourette's syndrome, that he suffered from Tourette's syndrome.
You said, Boris Johnson, that he was rude in ways that people would like to be rude, but didn't dare to be themselves. You are too. Let me quote...
No, I think we've been all that, Matthew.
Quote Boris Johnson here.
No.
If gay marriage was
Samuel.
Okay...
No, we're talking about Samuel. We're talking about Samuel. And the great thing about Samuel, and perhaps I can just cut to the, get to the end of this particular passage of argument and anticipate your point by saying that although he specialised in this kind of rudeness, he was, I think, a deeply sensitive and compassionate guy, and he wanted to help people insofar as he possibly could.
Now, you see, what you haven't realised, Boris Johnson, is that was the point I was going to conclude with and say that it applied to you too. If gay marriage was okay, you said, and I was uncertain on the issue, then I saw no reason in principle why a union should not be consecrated between three men as well as two men, or indeed three men and a dog. You could imagine Samuel Johnson saying that, and you could also imagine him not really meaning it, and I...
No, if you think about Samuel, what his real feelings were. You think about the violence with which he abominated slavery and the way he attacked those who supported slavery. Hester Thrale said she never saw anybody who felt such pity for the poor.
Do you think that he became, as his life proceeded, a little bit of a caricature of himself, that he began to parody himself because he found out what amused, amazed, astounded or made people laugh?
I'm not certain of that. I hadn't thought that before. I mean, I think that he always longed for recognition. I don't see him
as
particularly
performing.
I think he always performed. He always wanted to overcome his opponent in argument in a very visible and public way, and an exuberant and hyperbolical way. But I don't think that necessarily became more exaggerated or pronounced as his life went on.
I agree. I don't think so. He once criticized Garrick for doing just that, that Garrick had to live up to a social reputation and a particular conduct, and he didn't like that. I think he was much more earnest and serious, essentially, than that. He had a great sense of humor, by the way. We haven't talked about his sense of humor.
It's a pretty bizarre sense. I mean, he'd be walking up behind a porter who's carrying a load on his back, and he decides to knock the guy's load off his back for no reason at all, or throw people into the orchestra pit at a theatre because they're sitting in his chair, or that kind of thing.
I am convinced that that Dr. Johnson realised how people saw him, found that it played well, found that it sold well, amused himself as well as others, and camped it up.
But that's probably the case since he was 3 years old.
Yes, I think you're resisting it, Boris Johnson, because there's an obvious parallel.
That's right. I spotted this a long way out,
And Peter Martin is resisting it because he's a scholar who wants to build up the serious side.
And you're
of Dr.
trying
Johnson.
To build it up because you're a brilliant journalist. It's trying to manufacture a tenuous link.
Not particularly brilliant, there's an obvious parallel. Anyway, let's move on. I'm going to attempt the impossible and play devil's advocate, prosecuting Samuel Johnson. An element of self-pity does come through lots that he said and lots that he wrote all through his life. And we keep reading that he ran out of money and constant financial problems, and yet the truth is, and I don't suppose he ever denied it, that a lot of his friends were incredibly generous to him. Peter, I mean, just tell us about how kind Mr. and Mrs. Thrale were to Samuel Johnson.
Well, in 1765, 2 years after he met Boswell, who was another very important friend at that point in his life, he was suffering from great depression. It was his second great mental crisis, following the one after Oxford. And they, in effect, rescued him. They gathered him up from his house and took him to Streatham Park in Southwark and nursed him back to mental health. And from that point on, he increasingly sort of lived there.
There was nothing ever between Hester Thrale and Johnson.
There were rumours, weren't there?
There were rumours. And, some of this controversy about his sexual activities.
Oh, the bondage thing.
Yes, and chains and padlocks.
What happened?
We don't know that anything happened. This is the point.
Well, whence these padlocks and chains, then?
That Johnson wanted her to control him.
But these occur in Johnson's letters, which are thought to be... thought to be metaphorical.
And in her letters, too, as Mrs. Thrale writing in her diary, she says, "The fetters and padlocks will tell posterity the truth."
Well, I mean, there are many ways to use fetters and padlocks.
Are they?
Aren't there?
Take us through some of them.
Are you saying they kind of had fluffy handcuffs at the foot of the bed, or what was it all about?
I mean, here's a letter in which he begs her to, quote, "keep me in that form of slavery which you know so well how to make blissful."
It's a fuzzy, puzzling a chapter or instance in his life.
It is cognate with his general autoflagellant character, isn't he? There's this element, this self-demand, that, constantly making himself right.
Yes, that's a good point.
Getting up to do things that, in the middle of the night, working, this guilt, this compulsion. His obsession, he's an obsessive compulsive, isn't he? He has to touch posts in a certain way. He keeps every bit of orange peel he ever eats or finds. And maybe there's a
I think he wanted to be controlled. I think he wanted to be like a child to some extent, to feel the protective care, to be controlled. He feared his own behavior to some extent, perhaps. One of the things that he felt really guilty about was the sense of indolence, that he was actually a lazy man, and it wasn't honoring God properly by doing what he should be when he was doing it. We all have this idleness in us.
And throughout his life, you can see his concern with his own idleness, either to justify it or to castigate it. Was he as idle as
idle?
He keeps...
The whole point is that he was possessed, consumed by guilt and a horror of being convicted of idleness by himself, because he was driven by anger.
Johnson is an incredible worker. I mean, his application, his concentration, and But he could work very fast. And so he was able to achieve, I think, a lot while wasting time a lot. And he was very conscious of wasting
time. He probably
time.
Had the classic journalistic temperament, which you would be familiar with.
Deadlines. Think,
which is exactly right. Yes. He had the classic. So what happened was he would spend a lot of time in melancholic depression, as he built up to the pitch of creativity that goes very, very fast. Then there's a brief moment of elation once you've done the thing, and then you sink slowly back down into...
Feeling guilty.
Yeah.
3 weeks before he died, he began burning his papers, and he burnt them all day, every day, for a week. A terrible act. Why?
It's one of the greatest literary crimes in English literature. Why did he do it? Because of this all-consuming guilt that he felt he would not go to heaven because of. This is a dreadful weight that was always on this man's shoulders.
And he dies still in terror of going to hell, and it also in very great pain. I'd just like to read you something that he wrote. He's talking here about an imaginary character, Mr. Sober. Mr. Sober's chief pleasure is conversation. There's no end of his talk or his attention. To speak or hear is equally pleasing, for he still fancies that he is teaching or learning something, and is free for the time from his own reproaches. But there is one time at night when he must go home, that his friends may sleep, and another time in the morning when all the world agrees to shut out interruption. These are the moments of which poor Sober trembles at the thought. Was this a great life? He was in many ways a great man, Boris Johnson. He tried so hard, felt everything so intensely, was so courageous and sincere, and yet died tormenting himself with the belief that his life had been a failure.
Yes, but it was that inner torment that drove him to be such a wonderful man and made him such a lasting monument of the, the risk of being pompous of the human spirit. The story I love most, this fantastic story of Johnson long before the end. I think Tetty has just recently died, and he's asleep in the house, and they come to roust him from his slumbers at 3 a.m. and he appears in a nightcap and a poker, and he says, "What, is it you dogs? I'll have a frisk with you." And they all go out and get... This is 3 o'clock in the morning. They are going to get completely sloshed, and they get on a boat. They then start monkeying around with the costermongers in Covent Garden and all the rest of it. And I just think it's fantastic. He's 50 when he does this, and he's a lesson and a reproach to us all.
My thanks to the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who chose Dr. Samuel Johnson as his great life, and to our expert witness, Peter Martin. Goodbye.